As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Should we bring in John Stolfus, Oppenheimer Asset Management Chief Investment Strategist? He joined us here in New York. Good morning to you, John.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Do you tell your clients a nice, beautiful story of optimism and hope about a V-shaped recovery in the global economy this year?
Well, you know, I actually am expecting a V-shaped recovery. We've had a V-shaped recovery in 09. We had a V-shaped recovery most recently out of that fourth quarter of 2018. There's a remarkable resilience that is built into the global economy as a result of low interest rates, highly sensitive monetary policy, not only by the U.S. Fed, but by central banks around the world, combined with counterinflationary trends in globalization and technology that are very much intact and make the landscape much more resilient.
Let's draw a distinction between a V-shaped recovery in markets, shall we, and a V-shaped recovery in the economy.
Oh, okay.
I don't see much of a V-shaped recovery in the economy in places like Europe. We've seen some very, very premature signs of stabilization maybe in China as well, but nothing like a V-shaped recovery, John.
I do stand corrected on that. It must be that it's so early in the morning. I think the markets do a V-shaped recovery here, but I do think that the economic impact will actually be much less, because I think the rest of the world is going to begin to get the what's been set by both the U.S. and China, which is called fiscal stimulus.
Okay. If this is a V-shaped recovery in markets, the V is the smallest V I've ever seen in my entire life. And this does raise a question for me. It never really V'd downward. It's just V-ing upward. And it seems like people are pricing in that there will be no effect. How big is the potential downside if the economic bleed through, to John's point, 2Q, 3Q is actually more than people had expected?
Yeah, well, I think that we'll have to wait and see. But, it would be a double-digit a decline that we could see, but that exists essentially from any catalyst that can occur that is systemic in nature. So, but we just don't see that. I remember traveling to China. My first trip to China was a high-level trip in 04. It was March of 04. I just left one big bank in the U.S. for another big bank in the U.S. And I left in September of 2003.
Is this a story about the Mandarin?
Well, it's
my blue light's off here. Excuse me. Is this about the Mandarin bar in Hong Kong?
No.
I thought he was going to tell us about his whole contract early 2004.
I'll never forget. As soon as I arrived at the new bank, they said to me, "Look, we want you to go to China." And I kept postponing it by weeks because I was looking at SARS and I thought, my gosh, I've just left one good job for another and they're going to kill me. But I'm so glad that I went in March of 04. It changed my vision of the world once I saw what was happening in China. And on visits there afterward, it continues. It's a right. Juggernaut.
The gloom crew loves ratios. And one of the charts that struck me this weekend was energy as compared to technology. OMG, it's 1999. John Stolfus, is it 1999?
I don't think so. I don't think it's 1999. I think since 2009, We've seen different forces in effect in the global economy and within the global markets.
So it's you're saying this time is different. What is different about Amazon, Apple, and the other 47 stocks that have captured all the bid, all the wall of money coming in? What's different this time?
I'd say one of them is profitability, cash flow, management, business premise, ability to execute. And the market recognition, both within the business community and in the consumer.
Can you be long them? I mean, can you be long all these glory names, Microsoft and the rest of them?
We would say so, and we are long some of, not all of them, but a good number of those glory names, as you so well put it.
Apple is the poster child for the moment, isn't it? We've talked about it on this program so much over the last week. With regards to what is happening in China, it is heavily exposed to the demand side story, softening Chinese growth, the risk around that. It's heavily exposed to the supply side story, the threat of disruptions to supply chains, and yet still, it's a couple of dollars from all-time highs, John. And this is what I've been grappling with for weeks now. Quite clearly, the risks around the outlook have shifted, tilted to the downside. You can debate the degree to which that has happened, but that's happened. That's just a fact. The price of the story hasn't changed. Why not?
Well, I think it's that what the market has seen over the last course of the last few years is every time Apple's future looks dark, it surprises to the upside and shows resilience. I mean, just with the Apple iPhone 11, when the numbers looked better than anybody had originally expected about a year later, right? We'd have to think that. I think the other side of it is, you know, when it comes to Apple, is just if we bet you if we all bring our Apple our smartphones out of our pockets, I'm willing to bet you that
you
most
want to know
of
what's on my smartphone out of my pocket.
Is that an Apple?
It's not appropriate.
You don't want to know.
It's not
absolutely not
for radio.
I will say while you're pulling up whatever you're going to pull up that will become some sort of interesting conversation later. I do think that there is a question to the point of demand with respect to Apple and how much a slowdown in a Chinese economy bleeds into global companies in a way that's not getting priced in. And I think about this at a time when we are looking at the potential for increasing bad loans on Chinese banks' books that will potentially quadruple or quintuple, depending on how slow the economy goes. And this sort of diverts some of the energy away from the PBOC in terms of ability to stimulate the economy. How significantly will it hit the consumer in China?
I think that is the real question, but it should be of some significance without a doubt. But in terms of the buyer of the iPhone, which is a relative luxury product in China based on per capita income, I think it might have a greater negative effect on Huawei than it would on Apple, for example. You know, in terms of smartphone sales as a consumer product, because the Apple iPhone is it's a luxury item in China. If you can, it's a status symbol. Yeah. It is a global pick.
John, thank you.
John, good to see you, John.
With us with optimism. He's very V-shaped.
Yeah,
incredibly.
What did you find on your phone?
With Oppenheimer. We would normally do an interview with one of our best labor economists in America, someone that Republicans and Democrats are forced to read. He is Jared Bernstein, senior fellow of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and as well the former chief economist and advisor to Mr. Biden. But Jared, this time I've got to rip it up and talk about Joe Biden and the struggle he's having. Can you explain, Jared Bernstein, why Vice President Biden cannot get traction with the electorate on what I'll call moderate Democratic Party economics?
Well, it's a tough question. There's a lot of competition out there, including the young Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar. But in fact, I think part of what's happening is just the nature, and I would argue the very unfortunate nature of the primary system for Democrats, which start in some very unrepresentative places. The vice president has South Carolina to come and Super Tuesday, and he's, as he himself would tell you, he's a fighter who's maybe down but far from out.
If it's about wage growth, do you get a sense that a large swath of Republican and Democrat America is just fed up with lousy wage growth and there's a, and I'm using this from Gordon Wood at Brown University, there's a new radicalism out there that doesn't allow for people like Vice President Biden to place?
You know, I actually have a somewhat different view, starting with the economics, which is that wage growth has actually been okay on average, a little better than okay. I mean, we have productivity growth that's not exactly gangbusters, so your wage growth isn't going to be maybe what it was. But in fact, at the bottom end of the wage scale, very low unemployment has helped push up wage growth. What upsets people a lot, makes them far less insecure about the economy than those wage trends would suggest, is the difference between what they earn and what they need to make ends meet. And here's where Biden and the other Democrats come in, because they want to preserve and expand the kind of safety net programs that help close the gap between what people earn and what they need, whereas the Republicans and Trump really do want to tear that away. By the way, you're going to see a lot of that today in the president's budget, which comes out later.
Jared, you're making some really good points here, and I'm listening to you, and the story you're telling is the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. And at the moment, the battle of the last couple of weeks is just a lot of Democrats trying to find small, maybe irrelevant differences between themselves. How does the vice president get himself back on track so he's the man to take on the president of the United States?
Yeah, great question, but very simple answer. If your theory of the case is that you're electable, you got to start winning. So it's just that simple.
Really?
Yeah, it's that simple. And so the vice president has some stronger venues coming up for him, and that's going to be make or break.
Jared, how important is it for Joe Biden to have an actual message that comes out there, like a health care for all or some of these other proposals that are viewed as more radical, but are at least proposals that you can sink your teeth into? I mean, so far, what's Joe Biden's kind of claim to fame with respect to proposals?
Well, first of all, as I said, the theory of the case is a return to normalcy, and I'm the guy who can beat the incumbent president, which is obviously the most important argument for Democrats. So once you get away from that, then I think your initial point is correct and misunderstood, which is that all Democrats are really pointing in the same direction. It's a matter of how fast you're going to get there, whether you're talking about Biden or Klobuchar or Buttigieg. They're all much more incremental in getting to universal coverage, for example, than are Warren and Sanders. But that's more of a diagnosis of just how ready you think the system is to jump from where we are to where you want to get, or whether you think you have to get there more gradually.
Jared, from the outside looking in, it looks like Mayor Pete's doing a great job of positioning himself to take on the president and win over some Republican voters. Just over the weekend, he's talking about the budget deficit. I did not think I'd hear this from this side of the aisle. He said it's not fashionable in progressive circles, but it's something that he thinks we should be focusing on. What's the response to that from the Biden team, Jared? What's your response to a focus on the budget deficit from Mayor Pete Buttigieg?
Yeah, so I'm not on the Biden team. Let me be very clear about that. And I don't know what their response will be. Buttigieg is right when he says that's not fashionable in progressive circles, but it's also far less fashionable in economic circles. I mean, it's widely recognized that the old theory that budget deficits crowd out private borrowing and push up interest rates is demonstrably wrong, because we have large budget deficits and very low interest rates, not just here, but around the world. So I think that perhaps Buttigieg there is just trying to carve out a different lane for himself and complain about our fiscal imbalances, which are severe.
Jared Bernstein with the Center on Budget and Policy Administration. Thrilled he could join us this morning. Jared, let me channel your inner LBJ, which is long ago and far away. You took an activist, what I'll call investment tax credit approach to business investment. Can the Democrats scoop Jackson and get on board some business initiatives to seize the high ground there?
You know, it's a good question, and probably the way in for the Democrats is twofold. One is broadly on infrastructure. American business really wants there to be a deep investment in public infrastructure, because guess what? They're the ones who have to drive over the bridges and roads and airports. And secondly, on green investment, I think there is a real opening for Democrats to suggest that growth can be motivated by investment in
Okay, great.
Climate
but
mitigation.
You sound like you're in Davos. We're not. Are we in Davos, John, this morning? I mean, you know.
I wish.
Do we have decent coffee? Yes, we do. It must not be Davos. but Jared, that's great. But how do you affect that in Washington? I asked that of Secretary Chao, the head of transportation. And, you know, I get the Republican line. Give me, not the Democratic line, give me the Bernstein line. How do you affect infrastructure or green across both parties?
You have to have, I mean, I hate to say it because it sounds so political, and I know it is political, but I think this is my only answer to your question. You just have to have a very different administration. And by the way, I'm not saying it has to be a D or an R, but the Trump administration just never cared a whit about infrastructure investment. Their plans are a couple sentences long, mostly asterisks, referring to a bunch of fantastical plans that nobody's ever seen or written down. So what you need is just a different group of people who are not driven by a chaotic minute-to-minute news cycle and are actually serious about public investment. There are a lot of Republicans in that camp. I've talked to them. They just don't have any power.
Yeah. Jared, we're sort of all circling at a similar kind of question here, which is, what's the Democratic message to counter President Trump's, which is the economy is very strong. We seem to be chugging forward. He's come through with trade negotiations. He's going to go forward with respect to infrastructure spending, he says. And the Democrats are caught in a circular firing squad. I mean, what do you say to that? There's no real message that's emerging other than, hey, we'll go back to something that's going to be less sensational when it comes to a news cycle.
Well, that's the huge challenge that you're posing. And in fact, there's no question that the economy is going to be a significant tailwind for Trump. I mean, for a lot of the Democrats, when it comes to the economy and the electorate, it's highlighting the fact to it, the extent to which it just hasn't reached a lot of people in a lot of places. I mentioned earlier that people are well more insecure about their paychecks and how far they go than you'd expect given a 3.6% unemployment rate.
Jared, thank you so much. Just brilliant. Jared Bernstein with us there with some careful questions on the Democrats and, of course, his former support of Vice President Biden. He is with the Center for Budget and Policy Priority.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Kit Jukes, the Societe Generale Arsenal supporter, also FX strategist, calling us out of London. He joins us on the phone. Kit, great to catch up with you. Your take this morning, and then we'll turn to emerging markets. The US is still slowing too slowly for FX to care. What did you mean by that, Kit?
Well, if I had a campaign, I'd sort of lead the people down. It's that if we look at the monthly change in non-farm payrolls and this kind of stuff we were looking at on Friday, they're okay. You know, that they were beats or they were decent or they were solid. But the year-over-year percentage change has been on a deceleration trend. And perhaps more importantly, the year-over-year percentage change in aggregate hours worked is now, you know, is under 1%. So, you know, the impression I get from that and from plenty of other indicators is that there's a very gradual deceleration in U.S. growth at this point in the cycle. I have fears that with the Fed having less ammunition now and with fiscal policy pretty much on hold till after the election, there's not much to kind of, you know, prevent that slowing further. But the consensus on U.S. growth doesn't blink, doesn't budge. 2%-ish for most people, you know, it's just going to continue. That's kind of in the bag. So, and until they pay attention, until the slowdown in the U.S. economy, you know, shows signs of picking up some momentum, it's just a non-factor in markets, and I might as well stare at it in a corner and talk to myself about it.
Well, in the meantime, though, Kit, what we see is the dollar that's stronger. We're down three figures on euro-dollar since the start of the year. Quite clearly, we're pushing something through this market.
We're pushing continued growth concerns about Europe. There are continued concerns about Germany. And remember, we're going to get some more German GDP numbers at the end of the week. We've got Eurozone industrial production numbers. All of those have looked very, very pretty bleak recently. The ECB has effectively no ammunition. The Germans have no real enthusiasm for easing fiscal policy. And when I talk to German corporate clients, they are long cash and short on great investment plans to go out and spend it. It's not an encouraging story.
Kitchuk's over in Asia, what do you glean from what the litmus paper of foreign exchange says about this viral crisis? I'm looking at Indonesia currency versus Chinese currency, and it's red zone, green zone. You know, it's back and forth and all that. Right now, it's weak Indonesia, stronger China. But what do you make of what you observe in FX about this viral crisis?
Look, I think that you have concerns, but the Chinese aren't going to be letting the currency just for now play a part in that. I think that's pretty important. So, we were well into it. If you think of the fourth quarter, the Thai baht was one of the strongest performing currencies, gaining safe haven status, until at the beginning of this year, people refocused and said, hang on a second, they may have shifted to a big current account surplus. They may have shifted to very inflation-fighting central bank, you know, all the things that make a strong currency. But they're also still dependent on tourism, and they have a border with China, and you know that maybe we should be concerned about that as well. And it's weakened quite a lot. So I think the market does worry about the impact on growth from the virus in individual countries. And I think it worries about growth globally for emerging market currencies overall. And we wouldn't have the Australian dollar all the way down here if it wasn't for the virus. But it says nothing to how worried we would be if the Chinese let their currency take the strain of the weakness that they have in their economy. That's the dollar yuan. I come in the morning and it's 7 plus or minus a marginal amount every day.
I'm trying to understand the reaction of the dollar and the dollar, how much it will strengthen as this virus continues to spread before it gets under control. And this plays into the bond market call here. And JP Morgan out this morning saying that the bond market in the United States is looking overbought with treasuries, treasury yields falling near cycle lows, even in the context of the coronavirus, given the fact that the economy is improving. And I'm wondering, do you agree?
Yes. No, I think that the bond market is looking at a global economy where, say, if the U.S. economy is slowing slowly without significant inflationary pressure coming through, I don't think treasuries are going to lose their bid. The Fed is on hold until it eases. It's not on hold until it tightens anytime soon. Yeah. Given this pattern, the Chinese bond market's on a tear this year, playing catch up for being range bound last year, and European bond yields are just anchored to the floor. So I think bond investors are still out there looking. It's not the bond market that I think the U.S. I don't think can damage it, but I do think that where that feeds through is emerging markets have been holding up to a degree in because of low yields and low rates.
Right. Right.
And two things could hurt: higher yields or weaker growth. Because in the end, weaker growth usually wins that fight.
Well, we've seen this in the last 48 hours of trading. Kitchuk, thank you so much. With Sock Jin as well. I want to make this clear to global Bloomberg surveillance, all of you listening. Lisa, I just think I'm completely skewed on retail because of all the empty stores when I walk or drive around New York City.
Yeah, there has been this huge transformation New York City is its own microcosm, right? With the whole leasing rates and the fact that a lot of owners of buildings can actually write it off as a tax loss if they don't end up having somebody in there rather than lower the rates. That said, there is a shift from brick and mortar. And amid that shift, there's so much noise that you're going to have a lot of people coming out and saying the retail numbers are noisy if they're not really good. And that's sort of my question is, how reliable are some of these data points going to actually be?
Why don't you ask it to Sarah House of Wells Fargo, because she's informed on the emptiness of retail.
Sarah House, Wells Fargo Securities senior economist. How much are people watching? How closely the retail number, given the fact that the consumer has been the main driver of the U.S. economy, Sarah?
I think it's going to be a very key point to watch this week and in the first quarter in general, just given that we did have somewhat softer spending to end the fourth quarter. But when we look ahead to the current quarter there, we are seeing that consumer is going to again be probably one of the stronger areas, just given some of the production issues that we're seeing with things like Boeing and the potential supply disruptions. And so I think, you know, the focus on the consumer, we're certainly going to keep that here in Q1.
So the consumer accounts for, I believe, about 70% of the U.S. economy. That's up from 40% decades ago. And a lot of people are saying that this has been the stalwart of the economic cycle. How much longer can that overcome the weakness that we're seeing in the industrials elsewhere, especially in light of what we're seeing with the spread of the coronavirus?
Well, I think it can for a good bit here, in part because if you look at what's happening with real income growth, so that's still growing north of 2%. So even if we get somewhat of a downshift here, I think given that, you know, as you say, about 70% of the economy is, you know, fundamentally still able to grow at 2%, never mind the fact that the savings rate is about twice as high as what we saw in the last cycle, and households generally don't have nearly as much debt as they have in prior expansions. I mean, this can go on for a good bit, but of course, if we get a much bigger hit to the manufacturing and industrial side of the economy as potentially these coronavirus issues compound, then the situation gets tougher, and you're looking at potentially a sub 2% GDP number this year.
I mean, Sarah, you lead your note with Michael McKee's favorite survey, which is the JOLTS survey. I think a lot of our listeners aren't familiar with that. Tell us about job openings and labor turnover surveys. Why are they of value, and what do they say right now?
Well, they're great value in terms of looking at the early signs of how demand for labor is changing. And I think the JOLTS survey has, in many ways, been one of the weaker data points for the labor market, where you have openings down at roughly a 20-month low. And so we are seeing signs that as the economy has slowed over the past year, demand for labor has downshifted. Now, you're still seeing companies hold on to those workers, evidenced by the fact that jobless claims are essentially moving sideways. But it does point to a downshift in hiring in the coming months, which will likely translate into a downshift in income growth as well.
Sarah, as we talk about the economic data coming out, President Trump came out with a $4.8 trillion budget. And one sort of aspect of this, among the cuts that he had in place, was a deepening of the deficit. Will that matter at all going forward for the economy? Because right now it seems like people have thrown the playbook out the window, saying that deficits kind of don't matter anymore in terms of jacking up taxes and jacking up interest rates.
Yeah, apparently they don't matter until the political winds shift and they do again, or potentially the financial market winds shift as well. So I think while it doesn't seem like there's been much concern about it from Washington lately, or in many ways in concerns in financial markets where, you know, if you look at where U.S. rates are, clearly no trouble financing that debt right now. But, you know, things can change. So you could end up getting more sovereign net issuance out of other parts of the world. And so, you know, is this, you know, can we do this as far as the eye can see? Probably not. And of course, there's going to be offsets in terms of what we're spending, in terms of those interest outlays, which are going to limit perhaps how we can be spending some of that money towards more productive uses and raising productivity where you can get a higher run rate of GDP.
Sarah, let's talk about the prospect of a higher run rate for GDP. The assumptions coming from the White House at the moment in its annual budget proposal, the White House proposal for fiscal 2021, looking for GDP growth of 3.1% in the fourth quarter of this year, followed by a 3% expansion in 2021. Can we really get back to that elusive three handle, Sarah?
I think it does remain fairly elusive when you just look at what are the underlying fundamentals. So productivity is, of course, a little bit of a wild card. We do have a lot of great technology coming online, but in terms of whether we can get sort of that broad commercialization of it, like we saw with you know, personal computers in the mid to late 90s finally coming on board, remains a big question mark. But what we do have a lot more clarity on is the labor supply. And, you know, if you look at what's happening in terms of your prime age workers, Basically, they're growing about 0.25% a year coming up here, and so you know that says you need a massive rebound in participation. Well, we've already gotten a nice recovery there. How much higher can this go? I think that's still a big question mark hanging over the labor supply and therefore potential growth.
I'm afraid to ask what age is a prime age worker?
Well, we'll just use the BLS's definition and
that's safe.
Stick with 25 to 54. So
25 to 54.
You're still in your prime, Tom. Just at the upper end.
John Sylvia would have answered this, Sarah with Morgan. He said, Tom, you'd be prime.
I love that Sarah just said, I'm going to go to an official definition according to the BLS.
Yeah, she finessed that well.
Trying to stay out of trouble.
Good Sylvia points this morning.
Sarah, great to catch up with you. We've got to leave it there. Sarah House,
Sarah Wells Fargo. Sarah, thank you so much, particularly on Jolts.
Security Senior Economist.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.